This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Swuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on African News Tonight.
He replied to the court, and I'm quoting here, "All of this is lies. I have not killed any Tutsi. I was working with them."
That's reporter Catherine Field describing Rwanda's genocide suspect Felicien Kabuga denying in court that he had anything to do with the bloody campaign against Tutsis in 1994. Full details coming up also. Russia is being accused by the U.S. African Command of deploying fighter jets in Libya. And armed criminals raided 5 villages in Nigeria, killing 60 people. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The U.S. Africa Command, AFRICOM, has accused Russia of deploying fighter jets to Libya, repainted to camouflage their origin in support of mercenaries fighting for Eastern-based commander Khalifa Haftar's forces. The statement added, neither the LNA nor foreign mercenaries would be able to arm, operate, and sustain these fighter jets without support from Russia. The United States' accusation against Russia raises concerns of a new escalation in the 9-year-old conflict. VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi spoke to David Deroche, associate professor at Near East Center for Strategic Studies, about Russia's attempt to tip the balance in the Libyan civil war.
It has the potential to tip the balance in the Libyan civil war, but so far the Russian intervention in Libya has not had success. So Russia previously had deployed, either directly or through other parties, their premier mobile surface-to-air missile system, the S-1 Panzer. And we've seen in recent weeks that over 20 of those have been destroyed on the ground in Libya. So this is another step forward. And I think it is correct that these planes will have to be flown and maintained by Russian Air Force officers. If they're effective, it could tip the balance. But if not, it will be an embarrassment for Moscow.
U.S. Air Force General Jeff Harrington warned if Russia seized military bases in Libya's coast, it would create very real security concerns on Europe's southern flank. Would the U.S. react to such a strategic threat?
I don't think so, to be honest. Libya is of peripheral concern to the United States, and it's seen as primarily a European concern. And unfortunately, the Europeans themselves don't really agree as to which side to support. So Italy is sort of supporting the Tripoli-based government of national unity, which is the UN-recognized government. And France seems to be providing support to the Haftar faction. Unless there's the potential for destabilization, like a mass migration episode, Europe is probably going to remain preoccupied with its own internal issues. And the United States probably will wait for Europe to take the lead before it gets involved.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov conveyed a message to Aqila Saleh, Speaker of the Libyan House of Representatives, who is aligned with LNA's Commander General Khalifa Haftar, that Russia wanted an immediate ceasefire and a political negotiation in Libya. Is that genuine call or a Russian maneuver?
Well, I think if we look at Russian activities in Syria, where you've had local ceasefires that have the effect of basically allowing the Bashar al-Assad regime to solidify its hold on an area, to depopulate hostile populations so that it can then basically ethnically cleanse them. I think we're seeing the same playbook here in Libya. I don't think that Russia really has a desire for a peace in Libya unless it's on Russia's own terms. And in contrast to Syria, I think that Russia feels that an intervention in Libya will pay for itself instead of draining money from Russia, which is what Syria has done.
Neither the Russians nor the Turks are willing to give up their gains in Libya, nor the Egyptians either. What kind of scenarios to be expected in Libya as a battlefield for a proxy war involving regional and international players?
Well, that's a good question. So Moscow has not admitted that they have proxies deployed there. They say these are private mercenaries, have nothing to do with us. And I think the Russian intervention is of such limited scale that if it doesn't meet with success, if it looks like the potential is to damage Russian prestige, they can withdraw with relatively little damage done to their interests. Egypt, on the other hand, is very, very concerned about having a hostile regime on its border. So I think they are in it for the long run. And if they have a reverse, they'll try to find a way to fight their way out of that reverse. Turkey, on the other hand, I think sees this as creating a safe boundary on its claims in the Mediterranean and possible natural gas situations, and also as a way of reinforcing its partnership with Qatar, which is providing a lot of the money for the Turkish effort there. And it's also a good way of Turkey showing that it is militarily relevant even after its officer corps was purged after the 2016 coup attempt. So Turkey and Egypt are probably in it more for the long haul than Russia.
That was David DeRoche, associate professor at Near East Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy. Rwandan genocide suspect Felicien Kabuga made his second court public appearance in a French courtroom yesterday with his family again in attendance. International Edition's Laurie London gets an update on several developments in the case with Paris-based reporter Catherine Field, who was outside the courthouse.
This court hearing is three judges. It is up to them to decide whether to transfer Kabuga to the International Tribunal based in The Hague. Their job is really just to look at the documentation, make sure it's all in order, verify whether Felicien Kabuga can be sent to this tribunal, whether his health is good enough for it, and whether the charges are actually valid. The only big announcement, which was quite shocking for the court, was when Kabuga was asked if he understood those charges that had been made by the UN tribunal, those seven charges all relating to the 1994 genocide, he replied to the court, and I'm quoting here, "All of this is lies. I have not killed any Tutsi. I was working with them," end of quote.
What were the main arguments coming from Kabuga's attorneys?
The main argument was that they feel he will not get a fair trial at the UN tribunal, more so if the tribunal hearing is in Tanzania. They say it will be enormously political. So they said that they would prefer it if he was tried here in France. The other application they made for Kabuga was that he be released on bail. They said that he is elderly, he is sick, he needs constant attention in prison, he can't talk to him, he doesn't speak their language, no one can understand him. The judges also rejected this. They said that given that he was more than 25 years on the run, they really cannot take that big leap and hand him over to his family, even with all the electronics that would be available to them to monitor his whereabouts. They said that they really cannot hand him over to them because there are agreements between France, the Netherlands and Tanzania, and also just the fact that this family network that Kabuga has managed to hide him in many countries across two continents for the last 25 years. And at the end of the day, the court wasn't satisfied that he would return to court next Wednesday when they're going to give their verdict.
I understand that he also made a change, it would seem rather abruptly, firing one of his attorneys.
Yes, one of his attorneys had a lot of experience at the UN tribunals. He'd been a defense lawyer in The Hague. He'd worked in the UN system. And at the start of the, it was announced that he was no longer going to be his attorney, his defense. And now he has got two French defense lawyers, neither of whom have great experience of UN tribunals. And so that could point to the fact that they're really hoping that this court will decide, yeah, it can be held here in Paris, that future proceedings will be held here in Paris, and perhaps hope against everything that he might not be transferred to the UN tribunal in The Hague or to Arusha in Tanzania.
Catherine Field was speaking to International Edition's Laurie London from Paris. According to medics and local residents, armed criminals riding motorcycles raided five villages in Nigeria's Sabon Birni district in Sokoto State, killing 60 people. The French news agency AFP quoted two medics from the local hospital as saying 60 bodies with bullet wounds had been brought to the facility late yesterday following the attacks. Kenya has stepped up efforts to find a local treatment for COVID-19. The Kenya Medical Research Institute, East Africa's leading medical research facility, is testing the efficiency of an herbal medicine known as Zedupex. Lenny Ruvaga reports from Nairobi.
The search for both a cure and a vaccine for the coronavirus has intensified around the globe, including in Kenya, as medical researchers race to find the elusive remedy. Dr. Festus Dolo of Kenya's Medical Research Institute is the lead scientist tasked with finding out whether a herbal-based drug will be effective against COVID-19. Zedupex, developed in 2015 by Kenyan researchers, has been used in the treatment of herpes. Tolo says his team does not know yet whether the drug will work against the virus.
We are still on very early stages. We cannot be able to really say, knowing that the herpes simplex virus is a DNA virus and the coronavirus is an RNA virus. This really means that we need to, first of all, confirm, check whether there is activity before we can be able to really say this is a product which we can explore further for COVID management.
Rudy Eggers is with the World Health Organization. Eggers says that standardizing the various herbal cures could be quite a challenge.
In other medicine, we find that there are very specific levels of the active ingredient in it. And in herbal cures, frequently you find very varied components and then also levels of those components in there. So in fact, you would have to standardize these cures to make sure that you know what is in them and what component is actually acting. So that's quite a step to be taken before you can really evaluate these cures.
Dr. Kefa Bosiri, an ethnobiologist based at the University of Nairobi, also has reservations about traditional cures, saying that mass production could be an issue.
The immediate challenge we would face is getting sufficient quantities of the plant so that we can prepare them to supply the number of patients that may require it on a short notice like we have experienced during this pandemic. So this would require a lot of work to go into identifying the best way to upscale the growing and the collection of these materials.
Despite these hurdles, researchers at KEMRI are pressing ahead with their study of herbal treatments for COVID-19. Kenya itself has seen more than 1,000 confirmed cases of coronavirus disease so far and about 50 deaths. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
The coronavirus has hit South Africa harder than any other country on the continent. So far, it has infected more than 23,000 people and killed more than 480. But the disease is also impacting the mental well-being of many people, coping with social isolation and the economic impact of the virus. Franco Pugelisi reports from Johannesburg.
60-year-old South African Wendy Jones hasn't been able to work for 15 years due to the debilitating mental health problems. She is not allowed to drive, and with the healthcare system focused on the outbreak of COVID-19, getting the right treatment has become a bigger challenge.
I personally feel more anxious. I get really worried. And who do I go to? Am I on the right medication? Should my medication be increased? I don't know these things. I need somebody to tell me. Your trust in the medical system as it is, it should be complete. It should be absolute. But it isn't.
As COVID-19 ramps up in South Africa, hospitals are seeing more patients suspected of having the virus. The pandemic is also causing an increase in number of mental health-related problems. But the leader of information and awareness at South Africa's Federation for Mental Health, Mazutane Mojaji, says most patients are going untreated.
While clinics and hospitals are open, very few of them still pay attention to current mental health care users during this time. And also, there is no screening for mental health during COVID-19 screening and testing.
Board member of South Africa Society of Psychiatrists, Kagiso Maroganye, says mental health care was poor even before the pandemic.
Now we are in the pandemic and you're finding yourself sort of on the back foot with an already fragile system and not knowing how to go about fixing it. But knowing this, knowing that, you know, it is a poorly resourced, poorly distributed system.
South Africa Federation for Mental Health, Mojaji, agrees.
In South Africa, only 5% of the national budgets, of the national health budget, goes towards mental health services. The return on the individual report launched by the Speak Your Mind Global Campaign in April shows that in middle and low income countries such as South Africa, between 76 and 85% of the people with mental illness receive no treatment.
South Africa's mental health workers worry about the aftermath of the pandemic. South Africa has been through similar health crises before, and the impact is lasting, says psychiatrist Maruganye.
There will be some long-lasting effects on your, on the psyche and the mental health state of the population based on what has happened before. We've had SARS, we've had MERS, we've had Ebola, and all of these have required some sort of lockdown or some sort of quarantine to take place. And studies emerging from that have found out that this has had a detrimental impact on people's mental health state. It has led to fear, it has led to frustration, it has led to grief and bereavement, it has even led to trauma.
Experts say they worry this time South Africa's struggling mental health care system will fall even further behind in meeting patients' demand. Franco Puglisi for VOA News, Johannesburg.
The Zimbabwe government has long promised a legal framework for regulating online communication. The government recently unveiled its proposed Cyber Security and Data Protection Bill. Reporter Kuzai Zanawashi in Harare has the reaction.
Nompilo Simanje is a legal and information technology policy officer with the Media Institute of Southern Africa, or MISA, a non-profit organization advocating for free speech in Zimbabwe. She says the group realizes the need for a legal framework, especially as internet use has grown across the continent.
We have noted the increase in the use of the internet for transactions, for work, and also for educational purposes. And the absence of a law that regulates the online space has clearly shown that there's a gap and that there's a need to regulate the online space and make sure that it is safe for Zimbabwean internet users and for the exercise of rights as well.
Munyaradzi Dodo is the editor of Open Pali, an online publication that covers parliament and political developments in Zimbabwe.
The bill has some positives. It seeks to address issues to do with hacking, unlawful interference and interception of data in computer systems, child pornography, hate speech, xenophobia. Those sections, I think, are progressive.
Dodo says the bill has its weaknesses, including its proposed ban of virtual private networks, or VPNs. These have been widely used when Zimbabwe government has shut down the internet and social media platforms. Simanje with MISA says the bill falls short of expectations.
Having looked at the bill as MISA Zimbabwe, we note that there's more work that needs to be done. The bill still needs to be fine-tuned. Our legislature should be guided by the SADC model law on computer crime and cybersecurity. They should be guided by the model law on data protection.
Among other things, the bill seeks to amend the Postal and Telecommunication Regulatory Authority of Zimbabwe, or POTRAS. Simanje says the proposed changes are worrying.
One aspect that you note in the bill is the proposed establishment of Portres as a cybersecurity center and data protection authority. That is a cause for concern among several other aspects. Zimbabwe's history of surveillance and even the recent remarks by Commander Ezaichi Monyo that the military will start monitoring social media to guard against subversion clearly indicate that there is a danger that this piece of law will be relied on to promote national interests or national security at the expense of the exercise of digital rights.
Dodo and Simanje both say more work needs to be done on the bill. Dodo says parts of the bill are vague and leaves a risk of turning internet service providers into surveillance tools for government. He adds that there should be more transparency on what happens to the data that government requests from mobile operators and how the government will use the data. For VOA, this is Kudzesh Navashi from Harare.
While the coronavirus has forced schools globally to switch to online learning in developing countries like Nigeria, millions of children without remote learning access have been left behind. 40% of Nigerians live on less than $1 a day, and only 1 in 4 have internet access. Ifeok Itang looks at how families are trying to cope in this report from Jos, Nigeria.
Seated under a pine tree on a sunny afternoon, 13-year-old Charity, Yakubu's older sister, Susan, is playing the role of teacher as she takes Charity through lessons she would have been learning in school. This has been their routine since March, when the coronavirus pandemic led Nigeria to close schools.
I feel very sad because I don't get to learn new things. All the things I've learned, I've forgotten them. So I want government to help us. By God's grace, let this coronavirus pandemic finish so that everyone can get to go back to school.
Nigeria's National Bureau of Statistics says only 1 in 4 Nigerians have internet access, but 3 out of 4 have mobile phones. Nigerian educators like Bala Babangida, the principal of the Unique Schools in Jos, says that while some Nigerians have been able to switch to online and social media learning, there are challenges.
Looking at the cost of data and even the devices to use for effective learning, it is a bit problematic to Nigerians. So I think if the government can do something about it, it will go a long way to help to put a balance between the rich and the poor.
With 40% of Nigerians living on less than $1 a day, the added cost makes remote learning for the vast majority out of reach. Veronica Yuba has her 10-year-old daughter with her at her vegetable stall to help with the sales. Ayuba says she would rather have a daughter at home learning her schoolwork, but she's unable to help. Ayuba points out that authorities are saying parents should begin to teach children at home, but she says she doesn't know how to read and she doesn't know where to start. Making matters worse, the restrictions brought on by COVID-19 have cost many their jobs, including Yakubu's mother, Salome, a domestic housemaid. There's no money, Salome says, including money for food. She wonders where they can find the money to buy a good phone so they can learn on the internet. To help bridge the education gap, Nigeria is broadcasting lessons on state-run television and radio stations while children wait for the pandemic to ease up enough to allow schools to reopen. Ifeok Etang for VOA News, Jos, Nigeria.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. and it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09.05 and 20.05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.